strengthening the population of Maine's and the world's beloved loons. Have you ever fallen asleep to the sound of a loon? Perhaps you're lucky enough to live on a lake or spend some time in a waterfront camp each year. The cry of the loon can be magical, haunting, thrilling. The loon is one of Maine's iconic creatures, yet it's vulnerable. Climate change, lead poisoning, oil spills, and human encroachment all threaten the loon. Several organizations are dedicated to preserving and expanding the loon population here in Maine and throughout the Northeast. So far, their efforts are promising. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn about initiatives to protect the loon and how community science projects enable regular folks to get involved. Maine Calling is next. But first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The call of the loon is one of the signature sounds of Maine. Loons are a beloved symbol of our state and its beautiful lakes, but they face threats ranging from climate change to human impacts. Today, we'll learn about efforts to protect and restore the loon population and ways for people to help. Joining me, David Evers, who is Executive Director and Chief Scientist of the Biodiversity Research Institute. Also with us, Danielle Dioria, wildlife biologist with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and James Peruk, associate professor in the biology department at St. Joseph's College and senior scientist at the Biodiversity Research Institute's Loon Center for Conservation. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you heard or observed loons this summer? What do you want to know about their behavior or how to protect them? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. What have you always wanted to know about loons? And we're going to start with you, Danielle. Tell us about the loon population here in Maine. What kind of loons are here? How strong is the population?
Well, we have a pretty strong common loon population in Maine. Primarily, people are familiar with them during the spring and summer and into the fall when they're on their breeding grounds, mostly on the inland lakes. We have a pretty robust population as far as the Northeast goes. Probably hosting about 72% of the Northeast population. So, and they're doing pretty well. I mean, there's always going to be certain factors that they're up against, things like lead poisoning or, boat trauma, disturbance. But really right now they're doing pretty well in Maine, and we're lucky to have such a great population that draws a lot of visitors, and residents love them too.
72% of the Northeast population. Are you talking about the Northeast U.S. states or even including parts of Canada?
I believe that figure is primarily the Northeastern U.S. states, or New England and New York primarily.
Okay. Jim, tell us about some of the threats loons face.
Well, there's a variety of threats that they're dealing with presently. One people like to think about is climate change, and we're trying to learn more about that. So I think that's a really fascinating topic. But along the lines, lead poisoning probably has to be up there. Organic pollutants would be one. Mercury would be one. I think my colleague Dave Evers could speak to that. Acid rain historically has been issues. Loons winter in the ocean. There's commercial fish nets that take place, and loons get caught in gill nets. Oil spills have been on the rise recently. And then if you look at just factors on lakes, you have human encroachment, shoreline development, recreational activity. So they face a few threats along the way.
All right. And I know that in some other states, they're of higher concern than they are here in Maine, right? Massachusetts, for example.
Correct.
Yeah. Dave, tell me about some of these threats. One thing I was interested to read is that botulism is a threat to loons. How do loons get botulism?
It is. So botulism type E, it's a natural form in the wild, but it's concentrated in some places in the wild, which makes it deadly for birds like loons. And so the story is in Lakes Erie in Lake Ontario, there are increased numbers of mussel species called zebra mussels or quagga, and they're invasive species. They're not native there, but they somewhat cover, if you can envision this, they cover the bottom of both Lakes Erie and not as much Lake Ontario, but they cover some of the bottom in Lake Ontario, and they concentrate that botulism type E. And that concentrated botulism is then brought up to another introduced species, the round goby. And then when that round goby eats mussels, that round goby is a fish. It's a fish species that loons like to eat. So it's the right size for loons. And when loons eat that round goby, then that high concentration of botulism enters their body, and that loon dies within a week or so.
So that's really...
Yeah.
It's not to diminish it, but it's really more of a threat in other places and not in Maine.
That's right. It's mostly right now limited to the Great Lakes, especially Lake Erie, a little bit like Ontario, but thousands of adult loons that migrate south in the fall from Quebec and Ontario die each year in those lakes.
All right. Well, one of the reasons we're doing this program now is that you have just come out with a book, Loon Landscapes, with your colleague Kate Taylor. Tell us about that book.
Yeah, so Loon Landscapes is really just a photo gallery of different loon species around the world. So there's many books on the common loon, but there was interest by us and the publisher to finally have a book on loons of the world. There's five species of loons in the world. The common loon is the one that we're very familiar with here in Maine. The common loon breeds here in Maine over winters. But in Maine, there's other species of loons that overwinter here, the red-throated loon. And that breeds in the tundra. And then other tundra species that breed alongside the red-throated loon include the Pacific loon. It's rarely seen in Maine. It's more of a western species. And then the yellow-billed loon is kind of a yellow-billed version of the common loon. So if you can envision a common loon with a big yellow bill, that species is limited only in tundra areas in Alaska, Canada, and Russia. And then a fifth species is the Arctic loon. The Arctic loon is mainly stuck in Europe and in Asia. So the book kind of goes through as a photo gallery of different species of loons around the world. It showcases their different habitats that they're in during the breeding season, the wintering season, and in migration as well, and highlights each of the five species.
Well, I want to add, and it is a beautiful book. Thank you so much for doing this work, Dave. Danielle, I want to ask you about the common loon, though. Coming back to this idea that 72% of the common loon in the Northeast are here in Maine, what makes Maine such an ideal habitat for the common loon?
Well, I'd say we're lucky that we have so many lakes with pretty high water quality values. We have some pretty nice water here in Maine. Loons need clear water for fishing. They're visual predators, so that's pretty important to them. There's a lot of habitat here. And we're also, just the climate of where we are. Loons are not much further south than Massachusetts, so at least during the breeding season. So they need, the right climate as well. And we're, a lot of our lakes are undeveloped, especially in the north part of the state. So we've got a good mix of habitat all throughout the state that can host them.
All right. Jim, I know that loons spend their winter on the ocean. And I know that the Gulf of Maine is warming more quickly than other parts of the world. Is that affecting the loon population?
Well, if you're wondering about winter time, so most of the Maine loons winter off the coast of Maine. Some will go down to Massachusetts, and I think Biodiversity Research Institute has shown some loons go as far as Carolinas. And I think, Dave, you can correct me, but I think even probably off the coast of Florida, off the Atlantic seaboard. So they're up and down the entire eastern seaboard. And in the wintertime, I'm not so sure that temperatures are going to affect loon shifts in their distribution and where they hang out, or much of their population. I'm wondering about oil spills, primarily commercial fish nets. I think they face other severe threats in the winter time than just climate change. I think the climate change is predominantly going to potentially be affecting their breeding range and maybe changing the quality of the lakes. So as things warm, we might have more runoff. We might have more nitrogen, phosphorus in lakes, and lakes would be less clear. And I think visible, having a nice clear lake is important for a loon. So in the winter, I suspect that might be less of effect, and we might see it more in the breeding grounds.
Dave, anything to add to that?
Sure. You know, I worry about in the ocean, the red tide. So I think we're all familiar with red tide. We can't go out and clam like we want to when there's red tide, which are cyanobacteria. And cyanobacteria increase in concentrations. They're, again, natural, just like botulism. So it's the concentration of cyanobacteria that causes problems. And cyanobacteria increase in concentrations when waters are warmer and when there's more pollution coming into those waters, nitrogen, phosphorus sort of pollution. And so that can happen in the coastal waters like we know here in Maine. That happens often, and I think it could happen even more often as waters warm. And so that's something to be concerned about because cyanobacteria is a toxin that does kill birds or dolphins or anything that really comes into contact with it. And there's freshwater versions of cyanobacteria as well as marine versions. So that's something else to worry about during the breeding season for common loons.
Hmm.
So I think in the winter also, loons will follow where the fish are. They want to have some place to eat and to easily access fish food. So as fish populations move around according to different temperatures in the water, that's where the loons will kind of follow them. So I think they're able to follow them, and that won't be as much of an issue. So it's really hard to say at this point from a scientific standpoint, what will climate change do to common loons? It's something that we're all still studying.
Okay. Well, speaking of things you're still studying, I know the Biodiversity Research Institute has been involved in a really large-scale effort called Restore the Call since 2013. Tell us about that and tell us how it's going.
Sure. So the Restore the Call is a project that was funded initially by the Ricketts Conservation Foundation. And it started in 2013 as the and kind of answer this question of, can we restore loons to areas that they were once lived, but they are now gone? And one of those areas are in Massachusetts. So in Massachusetts, a loon was extirpated back around 1900, and it came back in certain places in Massachusetts in the Quabbin Reservoir area in 1975. And because loons really colonize or expand into an area very slowly, the population in the Quabbin area has built up over time, but still there's only 44 pairs of loons in all of Massachusetts, even though it's been 45 years since they've returned. So we are working with the state agencies, the wildlife agencies in Massachusetts, to identify areas that they still would like to have, that still have good habitat for breeding loons, and to bring loons, loon chicks, to those areas to repopulate or rewild those areas with common loons, because it would take otherwise decades and decades for loons to do it on themselves. And there are a lot of areas in Massachusetts that are very wild and are very good habitat for loons still. I always think from a Mainer standpoint that is Boston and greater Boston, that's a big city. And where are the places the loons can still live? Well, there's a lot of habitat for breeding loons statewide in Massachusetts. And one of the areas that we chose is south of Boston. And with the initial funding, we were able to release 24 loon chicks that we brought down to our translocation site to this very good habitat. And the loon chicks came from Maine and New York. And it was 3 years of translocating loon chicks. They're usually around 6 weeks of age. And we're very careful and very thorough. We have a veterinarian that helps us with this sort of process. We raise them in a pen for a few weeks, and then we release them into the wild. And the good question at the time was, will these loon chicks return to those lakes? Or will they return back to the lakes that they actually hatched from in Maine and New York? Well, we found the good news in restarting populations. We found, which we did know at the time, but we know now, that 9 of our 24 loon chicks that were released in Massachusetts returned. And then one of those loon chicks this year, as a five-year-old, actually paired up with another female and produced a chick in that area for the first time in 120 years. So it's been a very successful sort of process. And now we're in phase two of the process. Phase two is to continue bringing loon chicks from Maine to this site and try to help restore the population of loons in that southeastern part of Massachusetts this year and next year. And then we'll have a second site in the Berkshire Mountains in western Massachusetts where we'll do that same process over a three-year period.
So this is a big year for celebrating for you all.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. So we're very happy with it all.
All right. Well, we're going to go to a call. This is Jenna calling from Westbrook. Hi, Jenna. Go ahead.
Hi. My question is related to loon behavior. You mentioned that residents and visitors alike really enjoy the loons. Do you have any can you talk a little bit about what like recreational boaters can look for, like telltale signs that a loon might feel threatened? Like, they seem to kind of stand their ground when they feel threatened. They don't necessarily swim away if a boater has gotten too close. So is there anything that boaters can look for to know that maybe they've gotten a little too close to a loon?
Danielle Dioria, some good tips. Somebody's up here on vacation, or maybe somebody in Maine is headed to a lake for vacation, out on a kayak or a canoe. What is the proper protocol? What's good manners around loons?
Yeah, well, we get these questions a lot about behavior and what people are seeing out there. Of course, when loons are on their nests, one thing to watch for is when the loon lays down its head and its body, and it looks almost flat against the nest. I've had calls that there's a dead loon. It's actually just a loon that's just about to slip off its nest because of disturbance. So ever see that, you're definitely too close. And then as far as birds out in the water, one of the things that you should look for is what we call the penguin dance, when they kind of almost stand up on the water. They'll open up their wings. They might vocalize. So any of that is also kind of, you know, an indication that you may be considered a threat and getting a little too close. And, of course, if there's chicks around, you should always use some distance. You should use distance with wildlife in general anyway. I mean, the best way to view wildlife is really through your binoculars. This way you know, you're not too close. So definitely give them lots of space and look for those two behaviors. And I don't know if Dave or Jim want to add anything there.
Jim, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to think along those lines, Danielle, what you mentioned too, is just listening for vocalizations. That's usually a telltale sign that a bird is stressed, especially a loon. You may not hear the vocalization from the young, but you would hear it from the adult. And so that's just something for boaters to be mindful of on a lake as well.
Jenna, thanks for your question. Go ahead, Dave.
Hey, I was just going to add, and one thing when I'm on the lake, if the loons do start calling, they start kind of swimming away from you. And if you hear the whale call, that's that long, drawn-out call, that's the first sign that they see you, they're a little bit worried and concerned. And then if you get closer, the next step is they'll start to tremolo. That's that staccato call that you hear that's repeated. And that tremolo call means they're even more nervous, more concerned. So you can kind of use the calls as you get close to loons to kind of tell you, like, okay, you are too close if they're calling at you.
All right. Well, Jenna, thank you so much for your question. I'm sure many people had that. If you have a question for our experts on loons, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post on our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Cumberland Crossing, a new retirement community offering access to Ocean View at Falmouth's Care Continuum. CumberlandCrossingRC.com. Bristol Seafood's Fairtrade North Atlantic Wild Scallops, harvested from the Gulf of Maine and found in the freezer at your local Hannaford. And Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping Maine homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine rebates and loans with audits and insulation.
A controversial motorcycle rally that drew tens of thousands of people from all over the country to Sturgis, South Dakota, ended a few weeks ago. The ripple effects are still becoming clear in states near and far.
Unfortunately, we did have an individual who attended that event who has now passed away.
Unpacking the aftermath of Sturgis this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up later today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. You count on reliable news, the truth, a trusted source for your information. That's why you're listening to Maine Public Radio, and why you also might appreciate Maine Public Television. Each evening between 5 and 6, there's a full hour of BBC News with a global perspective on the top news of the day. Following that at 6, there's the PBS News Hour, which is also available at 7 each evening. A full hour in-depth analysis of the day's events and issues. The Maine Public Television early evening news block schedule can be seen at mainepublic.org. Please click on the television drop-down to see it.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, yep, the loon population in Maine and beyond. Joining me, Danielle Dioria, a wildlife biologist with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Jim Peruk, senior scientist at the Biodiversity Research Institute's Loon Center for Conversation. And Dave Evers, executive director and chief scientist at BRI. We invite you to be part of the conversation. You can send an email, a brief email, to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now, Tracy Hart, who is a conservation biologist with Maine Audubon. Thanks so much for joining us, Tracy, and tell us about the number of projects Maine Audubon is doing to help with loon conservation. The big one I think many people have heard of is the Maine Loon Count.
Yes, hi. Well, thanks for having me call in. The annual loon count is the one that most people have heard of, but it's actually part of what we call the Maine Loon Project, and that's a collection of projects that work together on a conservation strategy for loons. But the annual loon count is a core piece of that, and it brings together over a thousand volunteers each year, at the same time each year, and it gives us a snapshot to help us track how well the population is doing, and also if our conservation efforts are working. So that in itself is a value to conservation, but it also brings on over 1,000 loon ambassadors who are looking out for loons each year, and they're doing a lot of local actions to help protect loons. The second part of the Maine Loon Project is, you mentioned lead poisoning in your introduction, and the second part is we help coordinate the Fish Lead Free Initiative, and that's designed to help get the lead out of Maine's lakes and ponds. So loons die when they eat fishing tackle mistakenly, lead fishing tackle. And so we do outreach and tackle exchanges. And then new this year, we're partnering with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and Danielle can probably talk more about this, to do a Maine lead tackle buyback program. So we have local retailers who are partnering with us to provide vouchers to buy back lead tackle. So that's second big part of the project. Yep. And
I just wanted to ask you about not only the lead buyback program, but the lead exchange. So if someone's listening to this and they have lead tackle, they can bring that into Audubon and exchange it for lead free?
Yeah, Audubon is one of the places that you can drop lead tackle off, and then it can be disposed of. And we also have on our website all the different areas that you can bring lead tackle. So they're called disposal sites. It's tougher right now at Maine Audubon because our offices are closed due to the pandemic. But you could even leave it with a note on the doorstep, probably.
And Danielle, I'm going to let you jump in here and tell us about the buyback program. How does that work?
Well, Maine Audubon's really leading that up. We were able to get a Outdoor Heritage Fund grant jointly to support that. And basically, if people bring in, I think it's at least an ounce of lead tackle to one of the participating retailers, then they get a $10 voucher to purchase non-lead tackle at that bait shop or tackle shop. And that's really to try to encourage people to get the lead out of their tackle boxes, but then also give them something back in exchange for that. And so hopefully people will start using the non-lead stuff more and realize that it's just as good, if not better.
Tracy, I want to ask you, we talked a little bit about the Maine loon count. That happened in July, correct? How was it this year? What are the numbers?
Well, you know, we don't get the numbers tallied until usually December, but we're trying for it earlier this year. So we don't actually have the numbers yet. It's more anecdotal so far, but everything's rolling in. Our regional coordinators are tallying things up, and then we'll go through and get a lake-by-lake tabulation, and then also we'll generate a population estimate. So we don't know for sure, but it looks like we expect the adult loon population to be on par with where it's been in the past. I have some concerns about the chick population this year, that it may be somewhat lower, but that's anecdotal, and we won't know for sure until the count is in. So time will tell on that one.
Okay, I'm going to go to a tweet for you, Tracy. This is from Taylor. She asks, how can I volunteer with loons? I've always wondered if there's an organization that needs volunteers.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, she can volunteer on the Maine annual loon count. So just she can email me at thart@maineaudubon.org. So that we would love to have her involved. There are also other projects that work with loons, and such as Lake Smart and Loon Smart, which is with Maine Lakes. And there's also something called Signs of the Seasons, which is looking at one of the factors that they look at is when loons come back to lakes to try to look at climate change.
Well, Tracy, I really appreciate you calling in, and we're going to put links to all sorts of to everything you mentioned here on the program on our website at mainecalling.org. Tracy Hart is a conservation biologist with Maine Audubon. We're going to go to Kim, who's calling from Penobscot. Hi, Kim, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a cabin on Toddy Pond. We've been coming here for 25 years, and there's a little island not far from our cabin that a pair of loons has been nesting on since we've been coming. In the early, I would say the first 10 years, we saw chicks regularly. But in the last 10 years or so, rarely, if ever, is there a chick. And there's another nesting pair in Toddy 1, and it's the same thing. What we have noticed is a lot of eagles in the area, and that has just been in the last, I would say, 5 to 7 years. And I'm wondering, and I'll hang up and you can answer, I'm wondering what effect the increase in the eagle population has had on the loon population along the coast of Maine. Thank you.
Danielle, I'm going to send this one to you.
Sure. So bald eagles obviously have been increasing over the last several decades here. And we're definitely seeing, potential impacts on all sorts of species in the sense of, you know, they're a top predator in our ecosystem, and therefore we're seeing lots of interactions of eagles going after all sorts of different bird species, and specifically loons have definitely been one that people are noticing out on our ponds. You know, whether eagles will go after the chicks, we've had a couple instances where they've gone after adults, primarily when the adults are on the nest. But so far, we don't believe there's like a population effect going on, and that could change, obviously. The thing that I'd like to caution with eagles is that, you know, we don't know what the right balance is out there for all these species that we've been trying to protect and recover, like the eagle. And so trying to understand, you know, how many eagles should be out there, how many loons should be out there. We're trying to see how things shake out and how loons will be dealing with this top-level predator more and more in the future. But I am familiar with Toddy Pond, and I do know that people have reported eagles being kind of an issue there for the loon chicks, and I think even one of the adults might have gotten it there last year or the year before. So it's definitely something we're paying attention to, a lot of, within our Northeast Loon Study Working Group, we are all kind of paying attention to eagle-loon interactions to kind of document those and see how things, how much of an influence eagles are really having on them.
And Kim, there was a story this past spring that was not an eagle preying on a loon, but a loon that appears to have killed a bald eagle.
Yeah, that was interesting. I think Danielle is actually the one who reported that. One of the things I was going to mention just previously on piggybacking on top of what Danielle said as well, is eagles and loons have coexisted for thousands of years. And so eagles kind of returning in higher numbers is not something that's, you know, foreign to loons. Like, they're aware of eagles when they're in their environment. They keep a watchful eye on them as well. And I think, like Danielle, we're all interested to see how this balance is going to play out. But this isn't a new threat. I just want to reiterate that. This is something that's been going on for a long time. And loons have mechanisms in place to kind of detect eagles. They communicate with their chicks. The chicks might move closer to shore if eagles are out. So that does happen. So just kind of supporting what Danielle was saying about the loons and eagle numbers.
And Danielle, can you tell us the story that you responded to this past spring of how did you determine that it was that this eagle that was found dead was possibly killed by a loon?
Yeah, so it actually happened at the end of last summer. But so we had collected the eagle carcass that was found just in the water, floating in the water, and adjacent to the eagle carcass was also a dead loon chick. Both of those were collected, and it wasn't until this winter, or almost towards the end of the winter, that we actually had the time and the funding to go to have those two specimens looked at. We actually sent them to the lab at University of New Hampshire, and we specifically said, we wonder if a loon might have killed this eagle, because it did have a wound to its chest. And so they looked at that very closely. There was an opening that was very consistent with the size and shape of a loon bill. There had been a puncture that went straight to the heart of the eagle. So all the clues kind of point to the fact that this was likely an eagle that was going after and actually had killed the chick. And then the adult loon trying to defend its chick and actually successfully killing the eagle but not saving its chick, unfortunately.
Wow. And is this a first is in the work that you've done?
From what I've heard, this is kind of the first documented case of an eagle being known to have been killed by a loon in that sense.
We're going to go to Rich, who's calling from Moosehead. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question. We have explosion of rentals in the Moosehead Lake region, and along with them comes fireworks. And I wonder if anybody's ever done a study on what the fireworks, how they affect the loons, because I noticed their reaction whenever people set them off. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Sure, Rich. And, you know, other people are asking the same question by email. People very much concerned about fireworks and their effect on loon populations. David?
Sure. I just spoke about this at another lake association, and they had that same question. And I don't know of any sort of scientific research that has been conducted to quantify the responses of loons to fireworks. My guess is that fireworks are like, let's say, like thunder. And so when there's a thunderstorm, sometimes a thunderstorm can take a loon off its nest and it'll abandon the nest. So that can happen. I think for fireworks, that could happen at a certain sensitive point when the loons are incubating on their nest and they come off the nest and the fireworks continued. Maybe they would stay off the nest. I haven't heard of or seen or quantified that sort of behavioral reaction. But in general, fireworks usually happen during, let's say, 4th of July. And during that time, most loons are at the end of their incubation or they have hatched chicks. And the more time that birds put in toward an incubation, the more they want to stick with it because they put so much time and energy and they're really close and they know when they're close. So I think it has little impact in general, but that's a guess at this point.
Danielle or Jim, anything to add to that?
I would just support what Dave suggested. That's kind of my line of thinking as well. It's great. It's definitely a concern. I'm not aware of any scientific study that's investigated this. And like Dave suggested, I think there's some anxiety without a doubt. And as the caller mentioned and others, this is a pretty common question that we get, which does then suggest it would be great for someone to try to collect some data on this. But as Dave mentioned, over the long haul, I'm not sure it has a strong deleterious effect.
Well, Rich, thank you so much for your question, a question several people had, as I mentioned. We do need to take another quick break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Northern Light Mercy Hospital, delivering on a promise to always put patient safety first. Learn how at northernlight.org/mercy. Girl Scouts, inviting girls to discover Girl Scouts, to make new friends, try new things, and grow in confidence. GirlScoutsOfMaine.org. And the Ecology School at Riverbend Farm, transforming how people think about science, food, the environment, and themselves. TheEcologySchool.org.
Modernist painter, poet, and essayist Marsden Hartley died in Ellsworth on September 2, 1943. Born in Lewiston in 1877, Hartley briefly attended classes at the Cleveland Art Institute. In New York, he studied under William Merritt Chase in the National Academy of Design. He had his first one-man show at Stieglitz's 291 Gallery in 1909. Through Stieglitz and Stieglitz's wife, Georgia O'Keeffe, he was introduced to the art of Cézanne and Picasso. While living abroad, he made the acquaintance of Ezra Pound, Fernand Ledger, and others. Marsden's paintings and drawings from the 1930s and 40s focus on the Lovell area, Mount Katahdin, and the coast, and fishermen of the Korea area.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Scher and Maine Masons, celebrating their bicentennial in Maine. Happy birthday, Maine!
On the next APM Reports documentary, lots of kids in this country can't read well.
Like, when I was just reading, I just didn't know none of the words.
But reading isn't just about knowing words.
Because if I would read a passage, I'm like, okay, what did that mean?
There's lots of research on what it takes to understand what you read. Many teachers don't know about it.
Why isn't everyone in this country angry like me?
Listen for What the Words Say from APM.
And that's coming up this afternoon at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, and we are talking about loons, what threats they face, what's being done to protect them. My guest, Jim Peruk with St. Joseph's College and the Biodiversity Research Institute, Dave Evers, who's executive director at BRI, and Danielle Dioria with Maine's Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. A quick email from James. How do chicks raised away from the ocean know how to find the ocean in the winter? Jim, I'll send this one to you.
Sure, that's an awesome question, and it's one of those we wish we were like Dr. Doolittle and can talk to the animals and get our answers and say, how did you find that? That would be awesome to know. But it seems that there must be mechanisms in place. There were some studies that looked at birds and found that in the fall, they tended to orient themselves south when they migrated. And so for loons, I suspect they have the same process in place, where in the fall they tend to migrate towards the south, and in the spring they migrate north, and they may end up using the stars as navigation. For example, they do have probably a magnetic compass in their brain that may detect a cardinal directions as well. So, but really, it's kind of a leap of faith, right? When that chick is in that juvenile leaves the lake, it's kind of like for Maine loons, it's probably heading east and southeast, and based on kind of probably the detections of the night sky or their cardinal directions.
An email here from Greg. We are lucky enough to have seen and heard loons who have returned to the Androscoggin River in green. But I wonder if nesting behavior is degraded when the water level varies drastically. We note that hydro dams downriver open and close to produce electricity in unpredictable ways, and the water level changes dramatically. Would it be helpful to minimize this during breeding season? David, I'll send this one to you.
Sure. So that is a topic that the state agencies, Maine Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and Maine DEP, Department of Protection, they work with the federal government on what's called the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. And FERC oversees the permitting of dams around the state of Maine because the dams are owned by a company, but the waters and the water levels are a public resource, the common good. And so the permits for the dams usually are around 25 years. And there's a whole process that goes through what's called the FERC relicensing process, where the different agencies and other stakeholders all get together and they identify, are there problems with the regulation of the water levels from the dam management? And that's usually a multi-year process. And sometimes loons are involved with that. So on different reservoirs, let's say up in the Rangy Lakes area, there's many different dams on the water bodies up there, like Aziskahas, Flagstaff Lake, Rangeley Lake, Moosuc-Maguntik, et cetera. And those dams are regulated, and the loons that nest on those waters are impacted by water level fluctuations. And so there's a sort of management process that goes on with the loons by putting rafts or artificial nesting islands on the waters and then managing those rafts. Or the company needs to manage the water levels in a way to keep them steady, so they don't inundate loon nests. So there is a whole effort across the state of Maine and then across the country to really minimize the impacts on water levels on nesting loons.
An email here from Karen. The July 18th loon count this year in Washington County, Maine, provided a high count of nests and chicks. Observers reported 119 adults and 12 chicks seen during the official counting time frame. But analysis showed many water bodies had only one chick or none at all, while one lake had six chicks. Also, observers reported nests with incubation by adults, but the nests were destroyed or any eggs disappeared. Will 2020 be a year for higher than usual chick numbers all over Maine, or will there be a confirmation that the annual count showed there were many threats to chicks all over Maine, not just Washington County? Danielle Tracy said they haven't sort of tabulated the numbers yet, but what can you tell Karen?
Well, yeah, it's hard to know without the specific numbers. I know in general, loon chick numbers have been either stagnant and sometimes even decreasing the last couple years. And so this might be another year of that. It's hard to know ahead of time. But one thing to keep in mind with loon productivity, a pair is not necessarily expected to pull off its chicks every year. I think if they're successful getting one chick fledged every other year, that's pretty common, and it's kind of a sustainable population even with that amount of productivity. So keeping that in mind is very helpful, just because it's easy to get worried when you say, oh, no chicks again, you know. But knowing that they're a long-lived bird, they're not expected to have young that make it every single year, and especially not two chicks every year. But it's hard to know the picture without the information from this year's count and how that compares to past years.
Sure. Going to an email from Sandy, what's happening when loons seem to be running across water over a long distance? It can be hundreds of feet with lots of flapping. At what age do chicks begin to vocalize? When did they start flying lessons? A longtime loon resident of West Pond and Parsonsfield was killed by an eagle soon after two chicks were born. Now the remaining parent is guarding and feeding its young. Jim, I'm going to send that to you. A few questions there. What is the running across the water and flapping?
Yeah, so there's two things that kind of strike me. First of all, juveniles, when they might reach 8 weeks of age, typically week 10 or 11 is when they're kind of strengthening their wings and their muscles. And so they'll run across the lake 100, 200 yards or more, kind of a pre-ritual for learning how to fly. So they're kind of, oftentimes they'll do that into the wind. So that's in terms of flying lessons. I think I've never seen a young bird take off from a lake without practicing multiple times. So I think that's probably what they're looking at in terms of flying lessons.
And at what age do chicks begin to vocalize?
Yeah, and vocalize, we start hearing young ones as well. Like they'll start to hoot as well, make a couple of calls. You really won't hear them kind of wail until they're much older, oftentimes after the almost near the end of the summer. So usually just the hoot call is what you hear young chicks communicate with their adults.
An email here from Kathy. Who and what number should someone call if they think they see a loon in distress? Danielle, is this a question for you?
Yeah, that's a great question because this is happening all summer long, really. And it always tends to happen on a Friday afternoon or on the weekend when nobody's in the office. There's a couple different people or organizations you can contact. Maine Audubon is one. Also, IFNW, if it's on a weekend, you can contact dispatch, the local dispatch, whether it's Augusta, Bangor, or Holton. There's some numbers on our website for that. That'll get you in touch with a warden who would be working on a weekend. You can contact our office in Bangor. That's where I'm out of, or one of our regional offices. It's often a difficult thing. We often have to make several phone calls to find somebody who's local to that area to help respond to whether it's a sick or a dead loon. But just having patience with us is appreciated because we're all kind of working together trying to get somebody out there as soon as we can.
We'll go to Peter, who's calling from Medway. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I was up in New Limerick on Nixon Pond around dawn this morning, and it was such a nice morning. And, you know, I saw a small asylum of loon, you know, making their way, creating a wake on the far shore. You know, we are so lucky, especially during these times, to have these loon around. About an hour later, I was having coffee with my friend out on his patio. A loon came overhead crying, you know, and, you know, a lot of people don't have this in their lives. I think we're blessed, really, to be able to experience the loon in its full loonness, if you will.
You know, Peter, I think so many people agree with you and just feel so fortunate to have loons in their lives. David, you're one of them.
I am, and I agree. I agree with you, Peter, that we are fortunate. And I think this project we have in Massachusetts is, I hear from people when I was just down at the site, feel that same way. So for the first time in their lifetime, they're at lakes in the summer in these places in Massachusetts, where they're hearing the loons call, those long drawn out wails at night that we all hear, that we really enjoy and love, and seeing and hearing loon fly over and doing the tremolo call. And it's just that sort of that rewilding of that, of nature, of that area, that I think we're all drawn to. And there is something that connects us with the wilds and nature when we do hear that loon call. And I hear it from your voice, and I hear it from the voices of the people that I work with in Massachusetts. They love it.
Peter, thanks for calling and sharing your experience. And aren't you lucky to have done that just this morning? We're going to go to Sharon, who's calling from Little Sebago Lake. Hi, Sharon. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wondered if we could revisit a little bit and talk about the trends. We had an exceptionally bad year this year on Little Sebago as far as the number of nests as well as the number of surviving chicks, almost to the point of half of what we had last year and preceding years, actually. So I didn't know at what point we really should be concerned that we don't have a sustainable trend going.
All right. And Jim, you're pretty close by at St. Joseph's College. Go ahead.
Yeah, Little Sebago is a great place. Hi, Sharon. Super, super place. I think Sharon's, observation and her comment is certainly legitimate. At what point do we start getting concerned about the loon numbers? And I think what Danielle was mentioning and certainly what my colleague Dave has found is that oftentimes it takes 3 to 5 years, you know, to really try to get a sense of what's happening on a lake. So the best thing is probably not to rush, and I think that's what Danielle was saying. I think Sharon was kind of reiterating that too, but wondering at what point, you know, do we really have to take a closer look at it? And, you know, whether that's eagle predation or something else in terms of human disturbance. And so at some point where you're looking at like a five-year trend or five-year or 10-year trend, that certainly would get my attention. So I haven't seen the numbers from Little Sebago for like the past 5 years, but I think if we could look at that over the last 5-10 years, that certainly would help us out, make a determination whether there seems to be something maybe peculiar on that lake occurring.
Sharon, thank you for your call. An email from Charlotte. On occasion on Biscay Pond in Damariscotta and on Little Sebago Lake, I've seen as many as 13 loons congregated close together. They were staying on the surface and sometimes formed in a rough circle. A couple weeks ago in Little Sebago, this happened as dark clouds were approaching. Why would loons come together like this, likely from other lakes in the area? David, do you know?
Sure. And think of loons, when we see them in the summer, we always think of them as being very territorial. They're paired up. They want to ward off other intruding loons, and they want to protect their territory. That's very real. But other times of the year, during the rest of their life cycle, you think of the rest of the time of the year, they're very social. So in the winter, they're social. They like to be together. In migration, they do what's called staging, and there could be hundreds and hundreds of loons that stage together. So they're very social then, and they're social at the end of the summer. So what those 13 birds on Little Sebago probably represented are pairs from territories that are starting to disintegrate. They don't have chicks. There's no reason to stay in territory, and they want to socialize. And you're right. They could be from other lakes nearby that they're just moving around and wanting to socialize. And then there's also part of the loon population, usually about 20%, that represent 3, 4, 5-year-olds. They're not on territory yet. They're in that breeding plumage, that black and white adult plumage. But they haven't matured enough to be on territory. They're kind of like, let's say, the teenagers out there. And so they're probably in those groups too. And there's a lot of learning and vocalizing and trading of ideas and thoughts between
them. I'm almost out of time, but I want to get in this email from Dre. So, Danielle, I'm going to ask you to answer this quickly. How come they vocalize at night? Me being 400 yards away from a pond, I listen for them after midnight.
Yeah, it's definitely a common time to hear them. As far as I know, they're kind of checking in and identifying where each individual is on their territories, kind of saying, I'm where I'm supposed to be. Are you where you're supposed to be? And that's why sometimes you hear the sounding off in the middle of the night.
Well, I apologize to everybody whose question we couldn't get to. Clearly, many people very interested in loons, and I'm sure you could contact anybody at Audubon, Biodiversity Research Institute, or the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife with your questions. Thank you to Dave Evers, Executive Director of BRI, Daniel Dioria with the Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife, and Jim Peruk at St. Joseph's College and BRI. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.